If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
A decades-old Killing Fields case finally gets a conviction. A former NFL scout learns his fate. A TV personality is sentenced to death. And a famous rapper waits on a jury. It's been a busy week. This is the 13th Juror Podcast, where we explore the trials, investigations, and true crime stories that everyone is talking about. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell, and this is Court Report, your weekly roundup of the biggest courtroom headlines, breaking stories, and the legal developments shaping the nation's most talked about cases. We're starting this week with a case that has been more than four decades in the making. And even if you don't immediately recognize the name Laura Miller, there's a very good chance you've heard of the place where her body was eventually found, the Texas Killing Fields. The Texas Killing Fields isn't really one single crime scene or even one single case. The name has come to describe an area along Interstate 45 corridor between Houston and Galveston, where, beginning in the 1970s, the bodies of more than 30 girls and young women were discovered. Many of those murders remain unsolved. The cases are not believed to represent one single connected series of murders. The term has come to encompass dozens of cases along the I-45 corridor. But there is one particular patch of land off Calder Road in League City that became infamous after the bodies of four women were found there between 1984 and 1991. And one of those women was 16-year-old Laura Miller. Laura had only recently moved with her family to League City when she disappeared on September 10, 1984. She was a sophomore at Clear Creek High School. Her father, Tim Miller, has described her as intelligent and musically gifted. But Laura also suffered from seizures that caused her to miss school and had made things difficult for her socially. That day, Laura wanted to call her boyfriend. The family's phone had not been connected yet, so her mother actually drove her about half a mile from their house to a convenience store where Laura could use a payphone. Remember, this is way before we all had cell phones in our pockets. So Laura was supposed to walk home afterward, but she never made it. When her parents reported her missing, police initially believed that Laura was a runaway. But her father did not believe that. Tim Miller would later say that he knew something had happened to his daughter. He searched for her, researched other disappearances and murders in the area, and begged for someone to help him. And for 17 months, he waited. Then, in February of 1986, a group of boys riding dirt bikes discovered human remains in an abandoned oil field off Calder Road. Investigators responded, and they found more than one body. One was eventually identified as Audrey Cook. Nearby were the skeletal remains of Laura Miller. And Laura wasn't the first woman who had been found there. The body of 25-year-old Heidi Fye had already been discovered in that same field in 1984. Then came Laura and Audrey Cook in 1986, and in 1991, the remains of a fourth woman, Donna Prudhomme, were found there. So that's four girls, one relatively small, isolated piece of land, and for decades, no one was convicted for what happened to any of them. But Laura's story didn't end in that field, because what happened to her completely changed the course of her father's life. After experiencing firsthand what it was like to have a child disappear and feel like there was nowhere to turn, Tim Miller eventually founded Texas Equisearch in Laura's memory. Now, if you follow true crime for any length of time, you've probably heard that name. Texas Equisearch has helped search for missing people all over the country, and Tim has spent decades helping other families do the very thing that he once desperately needed someone to help him do, search for his child. But all those years later, Tim was still looking for answers about Laura. And eventually, one man in particular became a focus of his suspicion. The name was Clyde Hedrick. Hedrick lived near the Miller family when Laura disappeared, and investigators learned that Laura may have known him. One witness reported seeing Laura riding on the back of Hedrick's motorcycle, and Tim said that he had heard that Laura had bought marijuana from him. Hedrick also had a disturbing history involving women. In 1986, he was convicted of abuse of a corpse after he admitted that he had buried the body of a young woman named Ellen Ray Beeson. Hedrick claimed that she had died in a swimming accident, but years later, her death was reclassified as a homicide. And in 2014, Hedrick was convicted of involuntary manslaughter in her death. Now that same year, Tim Miller filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Hedrick for Laura's death. Hedrick never answered the lawsuit, and years later, in 2022, a judge entered a $24 million default judgment in Tim's favor. But Hedrick continued to publicly deny killing Laura. And then, more than 35 years after Laura disappeared, this case took a turn that I don't think anyone could have predicted. Another man entered Tim Miller's life. His name was James Dolphs Elmore Jr. Elmore had been a longtime friend of Clyde Hedrick, and beginning in 2022, Elmore started talking to Tim. And not just once or twice, not a couple little conversations here and there. Those two men would meet and speak more than 30 times. And according to prosecutors, Elmore began telling the father of this murdered 16-year-old girl details about what happened the night she died. Elmore claimed that he was there when it happened. He said that Laura had been with him and Hedrick. Elmore also admitted that he was involved in what happened afterward, including the disposal of Laura's body in the Calder Road field. So Tim did something kind of remarkable. He kept talking to this guy. He met with Elmore again and again, gathering information and recording some of their interactions. At one point, Elmore actually took Tim to locations connected to Laura's death. Now, think about that for a second. Nearly 40 years after losing his daughter, Tim Miller was sitting beside a man who claimed to have been there when she died. And instead of walking away or doing something else, Tim kept him talking because he wanted the truth. And eventually, those conversations became a major part of the case against Elmore. According to prosecutors, and based largely on Elmore's own statements, Elmore prepared a large dose of cocaine that Hedrick then administered to Laura, causing her to overdose. Prosecutors argued that Elmore's actions recklessly caused Laura's death, and that is why this wasn't a murder prosecution. James Elmore was charged with manslaughter. He was also indicted on charges related to allegedly helping conceal the bodies of Laura Miller and Audrey Cook, although prosecutors did not pursue those charges in this trial. Meanwhile, prosecutors were finally preparing to take another major step. Earlier this year, the Galveston County District Attorney's Office announced that it intended to seek indictments against Clyde Hedrick in connection with all four of the Calder Road victims. That's Laura Miller, Audrey Cook, Heidi Fey, and Donna Prudhomme. But that trial would never happen. In March, before prosecutors could present the case to a grand jury, 72-year-old Clyde Hedrick died while hospitalized. Authorities said that he removed his breathing tube, which contributed to his death, and the Galveston County DA described his death as a suicide. Days later, James Elmore was arrested. And last week, 42 years after Laura Miller walked to that payphone and never came home, James Elmore finally stood trial. The prosecution's case relied heavily on his own words. The defense argued that Elmore didn't kill Laura and essentially pointed the finger at the man who could no longer defend himself, which is Clyde Hedrick. But Elmore's attorneys also made an interesting argument that without Elmore talking in the first place, investigators probably never would have learned what happened to Laura. But the jury wasn't persuaded. On September 2nd, after 48 minutes of deliberations, they found James Elmore guilty of manslaughter. Then came the sentencing. The jury heard additional evidence, including testimony from a woman who said that Elmore had attempted to kidnap her when she was a teenager in the 80s. Prosecutors also presented evidence that investigators found more than a dozen images of child sexual abuse material on Elmore's phone during this investigation. The jury only deliberated for 30 minutes, and they gave him the maximum, 20 years in prison. James Elmore is now the first person ever convicted in connection with any of the four women whose bodies were found in that Calder Road field. His defense is appealing the conviction, and this may not be the end of his legal problems. Prosecutors say that he still faces a separate child sexual abuse material case, and they have left open the possibility of prosecuting the evidence tampering charges involving the disposal of Laura Miller and Audrey Cook's bodies. But there's something important to keep in perspective here. This verdict doesn't solve the Texas killing fields, and it doesn't even solve all of the deaths connected to that one field off of Calder Road. Most of the cases associated with the broader killing fields remain unsolved, and investigators have long believed that multiple perpetrators may be responsible. But what this verdict does provide is accountability in one piece of a mystery that has haunted families in that area for decades. And for Tim Miller, it came 42 years after his 16-year-old daughter disappeared. Laura's murder changed the entire direction of his life. He spent decades searching for answers for her, and in the process, built an organization dedicated to making sure that other families don't have to search alone. So there's something incredibly full circle about the fact that, ultimately, Tim's own persistence became such an important part of the evidence that finally put someone behind bars in connection with Laura's death. Next up, we have a major sentencing update in a case that we've talked about before. Former Tennessee Titans scout Blaze Taylor. Just as a quick reminder, this case goes back to February of 2023. Jade Benning was 24 years old and 24 weeks pregnant with a baby girl that she planned to name Ivy. On February 25th, Jade invited Blaze over to her Nashville apartment where they spent part of the evening painting canvases for Ivy's nursery. Later that night, Jade called her childhood best friend. During that call, her friend testified that she heard Jade confront Blaze, saying things like, "What did you put in my drink?" and saying that she couldn't even walk straight. One of the last things that her friend heard Jade say was, "You did this so something would happen to the baby." Now, Blaze later called 911 and told the dispatcher that Jade appeared to be having an allergic reaction, but prosecutors argued that Blaze had intentionally poisoned Jade by putting a lethal dose of cocaine into her drink because he didn't want her to have the baby. Now, Jade was rushed to the hospital where doctors found an extremely high level of cocaine in her system. Her cause of death was ultimately determined to be acute cocaine toxicity. The baby died 2 days later, on February 27th. Jade remained on life support until March 6th, her 25th birthday, when she also died. This summer, the jury found Blaze guilty of second-degree murder in Jade's death, first-degree premeditated murder in Ivy's death, and felony murder in both deaths. And this week, he returned to court for sentencing. The defense submitted 87 letters on Blaze's behalf from family members, former teammates, coaches, former girlfriends, even his kindergarten teacher. Those letters described Blaze as a man of honesty, faith, and accomplishment. But prosecutor Jan Norman pointed out something pretty striking. Not one of those 87 letters mentioned Jade. Not one mentioned Ivy. And not one addressed what the jury had just found Blaze responsible for doing. Then Jade's family had their opportunity to address the court. Her mother said that one of the hardest things for her to live with is knowing that Jade believed she was safe that night. She said that she thinks about her daughter realizing that something was wrong, becoming afraid, and then not knowing whether she was going to be okay. Then came the big question for the judge. So Blaze was already facing life sentences, but those sentences could run concurrently, meaning at the same time, or consecutively, meaning one after another. And Judge Steve Dozier decided that they would be consecutive. He said that both Jade and Ivy deserved a just punishment for their deaths and described what Blaze did as showing a level of cruelty, calculation, and inhumanity that went far beyond an impulsive act. So Blaze Taylor was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences for felony murder, plus another 22 years for the second-degree murder conviction. WSMV reports that the consecutive life sentences alone mean that Blaze would have to serve 102 years before he could potentially be released. Blaze's attorney has already made it clear that this isn't over. She called the sentence harsh and described the trial as a flawed trial of a tenuous case, saying that they intend to appeal. For Jade's family, though, her father said that the sentence gives them some closure, even though it obviously can't bring Jade or Ivy back. And now, they're turning their attention toward Jade's legacy. Her father says that the family plans to establish a scholarship in her name. We'll be right back.
No data, no AI. It's just that simple. Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hot Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it, giving your business a competitive advantage. When your data moves freely, innovation moves faster, giving you the freedom to build, train, and do more with your data. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. With global scale, enterprise performance, and predictable pricing, Wasabi helps organizations focus on innovation instead of cloud bills. Companies that are paying more in fees than in actual storage costs can fall behind. Don't let it happen. When your AI needs your data and you have a budget to meet, get Wasabi. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And from a case where forensic evidence helped prosecutors secure a murder conviction, we are now going to move into a story that shows what can happen when the integrity of that forensic evidence itself comes into question. Because a former Colorado Bureau of Investigation forensic scientist is now going to prison for manipulating DNA data in criminal cases. And y'all, the fallout from what she did could continue for years. Her name is Yvonne Missy Woods. Woods worked as a forensic scientist for the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, or CBI, for nearly 30 years, from 1994 until 2023. Her job put her in an incredibly important position within the criminal justice system. She analyzed DNA evidence in cases involving sexual assaults, murders, robberies, and other serious crimes. Investigators, prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, juries, everybody relied on the accuracy of that work. And now, the state is having to go back and question her involvement in more than 1,000 cases. Yes, you heard that right. More than 1,000 cases. Now, this all began unraveling in September of 2023, when an intern at the CBI discovered missing DNA data in a case that Woods had worked in 2018. Now, that discovery prompted a larger review, and investigators began finding similar problems. Woods had altered or deleted DNA data. She deleted information showing that she had failed to properly troubleshoot problems during testing. And in some cases, she actually manipulated data in ways that allowed her to move through cases more quickly rather than performing the additional testing that should have been done. Eventually, CBI brought in investigators from South Dakota to conduct an independent criminal investigation because they were investigating one of their own scientists. And what they found was massive. As the state continued reviewing her work, officials ultimately identified problems affecting roughly 1,100 cases. Now, I want to make an important distinction here because there are several different numbers being reported with this story. That does not mean that investigators proved that Woods falsified the final DNA report in more than 1,000 criminal cases. The criminal investigation specifically identified 53 cases involving false or misleading reports or statements. So in 52 of those cases, investigators say that Woods issued lab reports containing information that simply wasn't true. And in one additional case, what she reported was technically accurate, but prosecutors say that it appeared designed to discourage a detective from pursuing the results. But y'all, this is the part of the story that really stood out to me. Of the cases that prosecutors were able to charge criminally, 41 of them never resulted in criminal charges against a suspect. And 32 of those cases involved women and children who had reported being sexually assaulted. In those cases, prosecutors say Woods deleted values showing that male DNA was present. Then she issued reports saying that no male DNA had been found. Y'all, think about the significance of that. These weren't necessarily cases where she falsely identified the wrong man. In fact, investigators say that they did not find evidence that Woods fabricated DNA matches or created false comparisons or produced false positive identifications. Instead, in these 32 cases, evidence indicating the presence of male DNA was removed from the data. And that meant investigators lost the opportunity to do additional testing or make comparisons or potentially identify a suspect. For some of those victims, their cases essentially stopped before they ever got that far. And prosecutors say that this was not a mistake. It was intentional. And here's another part that makes this even more troubling. Concerns about Woods' work didn't begin in 2023. According to an internal CBI investigation, another employee raised concerns about her testing as far back as 2014. Then in 2018, Woods was temporarily removed from DNA casework after another employee accused her of manipulating data. But she eventually returned to that work. And it wasn't until that intern discovered the missing information in 2023 that this full investigation began. Woods left CBI later that year, and the consequences have not been limited to cases that never resulted in arrests, because at least one murder conviction has already been vacated. Michael Clark had been convicted of murder in a case where Woods handled DNA evidence and testified at trial. He was released from prison in 2025 after his attorneys challenged the integrity of that evidence. Prosecutors have said that they intend to retry him. In two other homicide cases, prosecutors accepted plea agreements carrying lesser sentences than the defendants might otherwise have faced because they were concerned that Woods' involvement with the evidence could cause the cases to pretty much fall apart at trial. And other convictions connected to her work are still being challenged. Just last month, a Colorado judge went so far as to dismiss a felony child sexual assault case after finding that the government's failure to stop Woods' misconduct amounted to, quote-unquote, outrageous government conduct. That decision is being appealed, but it shows you just how far the ripple effects of this scandal could potentially reach. Because every single time that Woods touched evidence in a case, attorneys now have to ask whether they can trust what happened to it. Woods was ultimately charged with 102 criminal counts. In June, she entered into a plea agreement and pleaded guilty to four felonies. That includes cybercrime, first-degree perjury, attempting to influence a public servant, and forgery. And this week, she was sentenced. Prosecutors asked the judge to consider not just the cases that had been directly affected, but what Woods' actions had done to confidence in the criminal justice system. So Woods also addressed the court, and she apologized and she acknowledged that she had been entrusted with evidence that could have profound consequences for defendants, victims, families, and the courts. And she said that she failed that responsibility. Her defense argued that Woods had become overwhelmed by an enormous workload, and she had previously told investigators that she altered data in order to complete cases more quickly. But Judge Andrew Poland emphasized that this was intentional misconduct by a highly trained professional who occupied a position of extraordinary trust. He sentenced Yvonne Missy Woods to 10 years in prison. She received 10 years for cybercrime, 6 years each for perjury and attempting to influence a public servant, and 3 years for forgery, with those sentences running concurrently. And even though her criminal case is now essentially over, the fallout from what she did isn't. Colorado has estimated that dealing with this scandal could cost the state more than $11 million. And more importantly, prosecutors and defense attorneys and courts are still dealing with the cases touched by her work. And there are victims who are now left wondering whether their cases might have gone somewhere if the DNA evidence that they submitted had been handled honestly in the first place. There are also defendants who have to question whether evidence used against them was handled properly. That's why this story is so much bigger than one scientist going to prison. Forensic evidence carries enormous weight in a courtroom precisely because we expect the science behind it to be objective. And when the person entrusted with that evidence manipulates the underlying data, the damage doesn't end with one bad lab report. It can call years of cases into question. Now we're going overseas for a story that caught my attention this week because the headline alone sounds almost unbelievable. An Egyptian television presenter and media personality has been sentenced to death by hanging after being convicted in a massive drug trafficking case. Her name is Sarah Khalifa. Khalifa is 39 years old and has worked in Egyptian television and media. She has more than 2 million followers on her Instagram alone. In April of 2025, Khalifa was arrested as part of an investigation into what prosecutors described as a large organized drug network. And the allegations against this group were pretty extensive. 28 people were ultimately prosecuted in a case involving the manufacture and trafficking of synthetic narcotics. According to prosecutors, the organization imported raw materials from outside of Egypt, used those materials to manufacture synthetic drugs inside the country, and then distributed them. Different members of the organization allegedly had different jobs, like some were importing materials and some were manufacturing the drugs and others were distributing them. But authorities said that residential properties were even converted into locations where the drugs were manufactured and stored. So this was like a huge thing happening. And investigators ultimately seized more than 750 kilograms. That's like more than 1,650 pounds of synthetic narcotics and materials used in their manufacture. Now, the case also involved charges related to unlicensed firearms and ammunition, and prosecutors did not portray Sarah Khalifa as someone who was just kind of caught on the outskirts of this operation. They alleged that she helped manage and finance the organization and acted as a liaison between members inside and outside of Egypt. Prosecutors also allege that companies associated with Khalifa were used to facilitate financial transactions specifically for this operation. Now, Khalifa has denied being involved in this whole drug organization, but during the trial, she became emotional while she was addressing the judge. She said that she had been raised by religious parents and that she didn't need money from drugs, and she maintained that she had nothing to do with this whole operation. At one point, she reportedly told the judge that she had never even seen the drugs until authorities photographed her with them after her arrest. But prosecutors presented testimony from 20 witnesses, along with digital and technical evidence, including messages, pictures, and videos that they said documented the group's activities. Then, before the final verdict, the court took a step that signaled just how serious the potential punishment had become. Khalifa and several of her co-defendants had their cases referred to Egypt's Grand Mufti. And this is something that's very different from what we're accustomed to in the American court system. Before an Egyptian criminal court can formally impose a death sentence, the case must be referred to the Grand Mufti, the country's highest Islamic legal authority, for an opinion. Now, that opinion is advisory, so the court is not legally required to follow it, but the referral itself is a required procedural step before a death sentence can be imposed. And on September 5th, the Cairo Criminal Court handed down its verdicts. Sarah Khalifa and 11 other defendants were sentenced to death by hanging. 9 additional defendants received life sentences, and 7 were acquitted. So that accounts for all 28 people prosecuted in this case. The defendants sentenced to death were also fined 500,000 Egyptian pounds, and the court ordered the confiscation of property connected to the crimes. Now, this does not necessarily mean that Sarah Khalifa will be executed. The judgment is not yet final, and her attorneys have said that they are appealing both her conviction and death sentence. That appeal can ultimately reach Egypt's highest court for these criminal appeals. And there's another strange wrinkle to this story, because this isn't Khalifa's only criminal conviction. She also has a separate case involving her former driver. Okay, y'all, this is really weird. Okay, so Egyptian reporting says that authorities discovered video showing this man being held naked at Khalifa's home. So she was convicted in that separate case and sentenced to 3 years in prison. But obviously, the headline coming out of Egypt this week is the death sentence. Sarah Khalifa has gone from working in television and media to being convicted of participating in a major synthetic drug operation and receiving one of the most severe punishments available under Egyptian law. Her attorneys are appealing, so we'll have to see whether that sentence ultimately stands. We'll be right back.
No data, no AI. It's just that simple. Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hot Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it, giving your business a competitive advantage. When your data moves freely, innovation moves faster, giving you the freedom to build, train, and do more with your data. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. With global scale, enterprise performance, and predictable pricing, Wasabi helps organizations focus on innovation instead of cloud bills. Companies that are paying more in fees than in actual storage costs can fall behind. Don't let it happen. When your AI needs your data and you have a budget to meet, get Wasabi. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, next up, a federal jury in Los Angeles is now deciding the fate of Grammy-winning rapper Lil Durk in a murder-for-hire case. I've never talked about this one on Court Report before, so let me give you the quick background. Lil Durk's real name is Durk Banks, and prosecutors say that this case began with the 2020 death of his close friend and fellow Chicago rapper King Von. King Von was shot and killed outside an Atlanta nightclub after a confrontation involving the group of another rapper, Quando Rondo, whose real name is Tyquion Bowman. And an associate of Quando Rondo was the person who shot and killed King Von. Rondo himself was not accused of killing him. But prosecutors say that after King Von's death, Durk wanted revenge, and he put out a bounty on Quando Rondo. Now, fast forward to August of 2022. Quando Rondo was in Los Angeles with his 24-year-old cousin, Saivea Robinson, also known as Lil Pab. According to prosecutors, several men associated with Durk's Only the Family, or OTF, collective, traveled from Chicago to California, tracked Quando Rondo around Los Angeles for hours, and eventually ambushed him at a gas station near the Beverly Center. At least 18 rounds were fired. Now, Quando Rondo survived, but his cousin, Lil Pab, was shot and killed. And prosecutors aren't alleging that Lil Durk was one of the shooters. Their case is that he was the person behind this whole operation, that he actually ordered and financed the attempt to kill Rondo as revenge for King Von's death. Now, one piece of evidence that prosecutors have pointed to involves the travel arrangements. As one-way flights were being purchased for some of the alleged co-conspirators, prosecutors say that Dirk sent a message telling one of the associates, like, look, don't book any flights under any names that are involved with me. The government argues that OTF-related money was then used to pay for the travel and other expenses connected to that attack. And several of the government's most important witnesses are men who admit that they were involved themselves. Casey Hester, who is also known as OTF Jam, pleaded guilty to participating in the murder and admitted that he was one of the shooters. Now, he told the jury, it's Dirk's fault. He said, Dirk put us in the situation. Another admitted shooter, Keith Jones, testified that shortly before the killing, Dirk offered $1 million for Rondo's murder. And Kayvon Grant, Dirk's former personal assistant, has also pleaded guilty and testified against him. But those witnesses are also one of the biggest parts of Dirk's defense, because these are men who have admitted their own involvement in a murder and who potentially have a lot to gain by cooperating with the government. Dirk has pleaded not guilty, and his attorneys say that he had nothing to do with the plot. Instead, they're pointing directly at Kayvon Grant. The defense says that Grant was the person actually organizing the operation, pointing to evidence that he arranged hotels and rental cars and purchased ski masks all before the shooting. They argue that Grant later blamed Dirk after deciding to cooperate with federal prosecutors. And there's another point that the defense has emphasized. The cooperating witnesses themselves acknowledge that Dirk was not at the scene and did not personally participate in the shooting. They also testify that they were never actually paid for carrying it out. So the question for this jury isn't really who fired the shots. It's whether prosecutors proved beyond a reasonable doubt that little Dirk was the person who ordered and helped finance this murder-for-hire plot that ultimately resulted in little Pab's death. Now, Dirk is facing 5 federal charges involving murder for hire, conspiracy and stalking, and if convicted, he could potentially spend the rest of his life in federal prison. Closing arguments are now finished, and as of the time I'm recording this, the jury has been deliberating since September 9th. So this is obviously one that I'll be watching closely, and if a verdict comes down before this episode goes out, I'll make sure to update you. Next up, we're going to another case getting a lot of attention this week because of the famous family involved. If the name K.J. Bierman sounds familiar, there's probably a reason. Croy Bierman Jr., or K.J., is the 15-year-old son of Kim Zolciak and former NFL player Croy Bierman. Now, if y'all know me, y'all know I am a huge Bravo fan, and I am also a huge Falcons fan. So I am very familiar with both Kim and Croy. Kim became famous as one of the original cast members of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, and she later starred with her family in the reality series Don't Be Tardy, along with dozens of other reality show appearances. And Croy played linebacker in the NFL primarily for the Atlanta Falcons. The two married in 2011 and had 4 children together, KJ, Cash, and then twins Kaya and Kane. Croy also adopted Kim's 2 older daughters, Brielle and Ariana. Now, Kim and Croy separated in 2023 and have since been involved in a very public, very messy, and very contentious divorce. But now, their 15-year-old son is facing an extremely serious criminal case of his own. On September 3rd, a Fulton County grand jury indicted KJ on 7 felony counts. Y'all, this is bad. It's aggravated child molestation, aggravated sexual battery, aggravated sodomy, false imprisonment, and 3 counts of sexual battery against a child under the age of 16. And because we're talking about minors and allegations of sexual assault, I am not going to get into unnecessarily graphic details here. The charges stem from an alleged incident on April 23rd at a Lifetime Fitness in Alpharetta, Georgia. Now, according to court records, a 15-year-old girl accused KJ, who was 14 at the time, of sexually assaulting her inside a changing room at the gym. The allegation was reported to police the following day while she was being seen at a hospital where an examination was conducted. Now, KJ denies the allegations. He was arrested on August 17th and is currently being held without bond at the Metro Regional Youth Detention Center in Atlanta. And here's where this case becomes particularly interesting from a legal standpoint. So KJ was only 14 years old when this allegedly happened. He's now 15. But because of the specific felony charges alleged, Georgia law allows this case to proceed in superior court, even though KJ was a juvenile at the time. And that distinction could have enormous consequences. Y'all, this little tidbit makes this such a different case, because if he is prosecuted and convicted as an adult on the most serious charges, his attorneys say that he faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years in prison and potentially life. So right now, one of the biggest fights in this case is over where KJ should actually be prosecuted. On September 8th, his attorneys filed a motion asking the judge to transfer the case from Superior Court to Juvenile Court. They're also asking the court to keep the proceedings confidential because both KJ and his accuser are minors. His attorney, Jason Sheffield, says that KJ intends to plead not guilty to every single charge. And the defense is already pointing to what it says are weaknesses in the evidence. According to Sheffield's characterization of the police report, investigators found no male DNA on or inside of the areas where the alleged assault was reported to have occurred. Now, KJ's mama, Kim Zolciak, has also publicly defended her son and says that he voluntarily took and passed a polygraph examination. Now, those are the defense claims. The absence of DNA doesn't automatically tell us whether an assault occurred, and a privately administered polygraph doesn't determine guilt or innocence. Now, on the other side, prosecutors presented enough evidence to a grand jury to obtain an indictment. But an indictment isn't a conviction either, so the state will still have to prove these charges beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, as of right now, KJ remains in custody without bond. He has a bond hearing scheduled for September 11th, and his arraignment is currently scheduled for October 14th, when his attorney says that he intends to enter a not guilty plea. So one of the first major questions in this case may not be about guilt or innocence at all. It's going to be whether a teenager who was just 14 years old when this allegedly happened should face these charges in adult court, where the potential consequences could mean decades in prison, or whether his case should be transferred into Georgia's juvenile justice system. All right, next up, a quick update in a case that probably doesn't need much introduction, the Menendez brothers. Eric and Lau Menendez have now spent more than three decades in prison for the 1989 murders of their parents, Jose and Kitty Menendez, inside the family's Beverly Hills home. Now, the brothers have never denied killing their parents. Prosecutors argued that the murders were motivated by money, but Eric and Lyle maintained that the killings occurred after years of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse in the family, and they said they feared for their lives. Now, their first trials ended with deadlock juries, but in 1996, they were convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Then, in May of 2025, a judge resentenced both brothers to 50 years to life. And because both were under the age of 26 when the murders happened, Eric was 18 and Lyle was 21, California's youthful offender law made them immediately eligible for parole consideration. So both of them went before the parole board in August of 2025, and both of them were denied. Commissioners raised concerns about their behavior in prison and rule violations. In Eric's case, that included repeated use of a contraband cell phone, while Lyle's board also raised concerns about deception and what it described as antisocial traits. Now, at that point, their next opportunity for a parole hearing wasn't expected until August of 2028. But this week, all of that changed. The California Board of Parole Hearings has granted both brothers an earlier parole suitability hearing, now tentatively scheduled for March of 2027. That's about 17 months earlier than expected. Now, California allows an earlier hearing when there has been some kind of change in circumstances or new information indicating that someone may now be suitable for parole. But here's what's interesting. The state has not publicly disclosed exactly what changed or why the brothers' requests were granted. Their family released a statement praising the decision and pointing to the work that Eric and Lyle have done during their decades in prison, including involvement in programs focused on rehabilitation and hospice care and improving prison life. But we don't know whether any of that is specifically why the board agreed to move their hearings up. And getting an earlier hearing certainly doesn't mean that they're getting out. Eric and Lyle will still have to convince the parole board that they're suitable for release and don't pose an unreasonable risk to public safety. But after being denied last year and expecting to wait until 2028 for another chance, the Menendez brothers will now be back before the parole board in March of next year. We'll be right back.
No data, no AI. It's just that simple. Until now, the data your AI depends on has been trapped behind ever-increasing cloud fees. Wasabi created Hot Cloud Storage and is redefining cloud storage for the AI era, delivering simple, predictable cloud storage for AI, analytics, media, and more. Your data is free to move, fast to access, and ready when your AI needs it, giving your business a competitive advantage. When your data moves freely, innovation moves faster, giving you the freedom to build, train, and do more with your data. Hidden fees add up fast as AI workloads grow. Wasabi's flat pricing eliminates all of it. One rate, no surprises. With global scale, enterprise performance, and predictable pricing, Wasabi helps organizations focus on innovation instead of cloud bills. Companies that are paying more in fees than in actual storage costs can fall behind. Don't let it happen. When your AI needs your data and you have a budget to meet, get Wasabi. Learn more and try now for free at wasabi.com. Wasabi, the AI storage cloud. Proud partner of the iHeart Podcast Network.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Next up, I want to take you to Florida for an update in a case known as the Hog Trail Murders. If you've never heard of this one, the name comes from a series of killings in southwest Florida during the 90s. Beginning in 1994, bodies began turning up in a remote, swampy, and wooded area in Charlotte County, north of Fort Myers. So hunters discovered the first body in February of 1994, and over the next several years, authorities would find the remains of at least six victims in this area, and most of them were homeless men. So investigators began noticing similarities between the cases and eventually believed that someone was specifically targeting vulnerable men. And the man that they ultimately focused on was Daniel Owen Conahan Jr. Investigators began looking closely at Conahan after hearing remarkably similar stories from multiple men. Now, one man who was in prison for stealing Conahan's car actually told investigators that Conahan had taken him to a remote area and offered him money to pose for nude pictures. He said that he became kind of freaked out after seeing a knife and ultimately drove away in Conahan's car. Then investigators learned about another man in Fort Myers who described a very similar approach. He said that a man offering him money to pose for nude pictures took him to a secluded location, tied him to a tree, and attempted to strangle him. Now, that man survived, and Conahan was eventually arrested and charged with attempted murder in that attack. And then investigators connected him to the April 1996 murder of Richard Allen Montgomery. Authorities said that Conahan offered Montgomery money, again, to pose for nude pictures and took him to a remote wooded area in Charlotte County. Montgomery was killed by strangulation, and evidence indicated that he had been tied to a tree. So, all very similar, right? Conahan waived his right to a jury trial, and in August of 1999, a judge convicted him of first-degree murder and kidnapping. He was sentenced to death. but Richard Montgomery is the only murder for which Daniel Conahan was ever convicted. Authorities suspected him in several other deaths associated with what became known as the Hog Trail murders, but he was never charged with those killings. A sheriff's office report concluded that the victims discovered within roughly a 10-mile radius were all likely killed by the same person, but investigators never established in court that Conahan was responsible for all of them. And the mystery only grew years later. In 2007, a land survey crew discovered the remains of 8 more people in Fort Myers. Now, 4 of those victims were eventually identified. All 4 were homeless, and authorities said that their injuries all showed similarities to the earlier Charlotte County victims. And once again, Conahan was publicly identified as a person of interest, but no additional murder charges were ever filed against him. So that brings us to this week. Conahan maintained that he was innocent of Richard Montgomery's murder, and one of the major issues in his final appeals involved DNA evidence. His attorney said that he had been seeking additional DNA testing since March of 2025 on evidence that was collected from the crime scene and from Montgomery's body. They argued that testing could potentially exclude Conahan or maybe point to somebody else. But while that request was still being litigated, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed Conahan's death warrant on August 11th, setting his execution for September 10th. The state court denied the DNA testing motion shortly after that, and Conahan's attorneys continued fighting to delay his execution so that those claims could be reviewed. They ultimately asked the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the execution, but those efforts were unsuccessful, and on September 10th, the execution went forward. Daniel Conahan was executed by lethal injection at Florida State Prison near Stark. The curtain to the death chamber opened at 6 p.m. The warden asked Conahan whether he wanted to make any final statement, and he said, "No, sir." The drugs began flowing at 6:01 p.m., and at 6:12 p.m., Daniel Conahan was pronounced dead. He was 72 years old. Now, 11 victim family members attended the execution, although corrections officials did not say whether they were relatives of Richard Montgomery or of some of the other victims that Conahan was suspected of killing, but Conahan became the 15th person executed by the state of Florida in 2026. But even with his execution, there are still so many unanswered questions surrounding the Hog Trail murders. Daniel Conahan died convicted of killing just one man, Richard Montgomery, but investigators believed that he may have been responsible for the others. But for those other victims, Conahan was never charged, and no judge or jury ever determined that he was their killer. So while his death sentence has now been carried out, part of the story of the Hog Trail murders remains unresolved. All right, y'all, before we wrap things up, let's head into juror notes for a few quick updates on cases that we've been following. We have one update in the Jared Breidigan case. Now, just a couple of weeks ago, I told you that Mario Fernandez Saldana was found guilty of first-degree murder and solicitation to commit a capital felony in the 2022 murder of Jared Breidigan. Prosecutors convinced the jury that Mario helped orchestrate the murder-for-hire plot and hired his former tenant, Henry Tenen, to kill Jared. Now, Mario's attorneys are asking for a new trial. The motion was filed on September 3rd, and the defense argues that Mario did not receive a fair and impartial trial. Among their claims, they accuse prosecutors of making improper arguments to the jury and even altering a key piece of evidence that was presented during the trial. They also argue that the state's case relied heavily on circumstantial evidence and that there were important gaps in the evidence connecting Mario to Tenen and ultimately to Jared's murder. Now, as of right now, the judge has not ruled on that request, and I'm not going to get too far into this one today because, by popular demand, the next case that we are diving into on 13th Juror, as soon as we wrap up Lindsay Clancy, is going to be the murder of Jared Breidigan and the trial of Mario Fernandez Saldana. So we're going to go through the evidence, the arguments, and exactly how prosecutors say that this murder-for-hire plot all came together, and we'll obviously be keeping an eye on this new trial motion as well. And we have another update in the Barry Morphew case. So last week I told you that Barry had been taken back into custody after prosecutors accused him of violating the conditions of his release. Remember, Barry is awaiting trial for the murder of his wife, Suzanne Morphew, and had originally been released on a $3 million surety bond with GPS monitoring and restrictions on where he was allowed to go. But prosecutors say that GPS data showed that on August 26th, Barry left home under an exception that allowed him to go to work. Except, they say he didn't go to work. Instead, he drove to the Denver International Airport, apparently to pick up his daughter. And prosecutors say that that wasn't his only unauthorized stop. GPS data also showed trips to places like a steakhouse and Whole Foods and a liquor store. Then, while he was in Denver, Barry was allegedly involved in this hit-and-run crash. Video that was reviewed by the judge reportedly showed Barry refusing to provide his identification or insurance information after the crash and offering the other driver cash for the damage. When she said she was calling the police, prosecutors say that Barry hightailed it out of there. Now, all of that became a pretty major problem considering the conditions of his release. So the judge initially changed his $3 million surety bond to $3 million cash only and ordered him back into custody. Then, on September 8th, Barry went back before the judge and she raised it again, this time to $10 million cash only. Judge Hopkins said, "Mr. Morphew has shown time and again that he has no respect for any order of this court." Now, prosecutors argued that the airport trip was particularly concerning because Barry could potentially have gotten on a plane and just fled the country. The defense pushed back on that, arguing that Barry has been dealing with this investigation and prosecution for like 6 years now and has never tried to run. But the judge ultimately sided with the prosecutors and set that $10 million cash-only bond. And Barry now has another legal problem, too, because of that alleged crash. Now, he's facing five traffic-related charges in Denver: careless driving, leaving the scene of an accident, failing to report an accident, driving without a driver's license, and failing to provide proof of insurance. Barry, just stay home. Keep it home. You ain't got no business being out. Stay at home. You'd keep getting in trouble. He has a plea hearing on those charges scheduled for September 15th, but he has pleaded not guilty to Suzanne's murder and continues to deny having anything to do with her death. But for now, while he waits for that murder trial, he is back behind bars unless he can come up with $10 million in cash. And even if he does post it, the judge has imposed extremely restrictive conditions on his release, essentially keeping him confined to his home except for very limited circumstances. And y'all know we can't have a court report without checking in on Murdoch, the case that never goes away. We finally know where Alex Murdoch's second trial will be taking place. Judge Deborah McCaslin has moved the retrial out of Colleton County and into Sumter County, South Carolina. Murdoch's defense had pushed for the retrial to be moved to either Charleston or Richland County, arguing that Sumter was still too close to the intense publicity surrounding the case, but the judge ultimately chose Sumter County. The retrial is still scheduled to begin April 5th, 2027, and Murdoch's next court appearance is currently set for November 13th. So, yes, we've still got a while before trial number two, but I have a feeling that Murdoch will give us plenty to talk about between now and then. And before I close out this week's court report, I don't think I could end an episode being released on September 11th without taking a moment to recognize what this day represents. This year marks 25 years since the attacks of September 11th, 2001. And I was thinking about that as I put together this episode. Every week on the show, we talk about true crime. We talk about murders and trials, evidence and verdicts. We dissect what happened and why it happened and whether justice was served. But 25 years ago, our country experienced what could only be described as the ultimate true crime, an intentional act of mass murder carried out in front of the entire world. Nearly 3,000 people were killed that day in New York City, at the Pentagon, and aboard Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. Thousands more were injured, and countless first responders, survivors, and families have lived with the consequences ever since. And after 25 years, there is now an entire generation of adults who weren't even alive when it happened. For those of us who were, though, there are moments from that day that feel impossible to forget. Like where we were, who we were with, the images on TV, the fear, the confusion. And then, in the middle of something so horrific, the extraordinary courage of ordinary people, firefighters and police officers running toward buildings everyone else was running away from, strangers helping strangers, and passengers aboard Flight 93 who learned what was happening and made the decision to fight back. So today, 25 years later, I want to take a moment to remember the people whose lives were taken that morning, the people who ran toward danger to try to save them, and the families who have carried those losses for a quarter of a century. 25 years is a long time, but some things should never become just another chapter in a history book. September 11th is one of them. We remember. So that's your court report for this week. I'll be back next week with the latest developments. Until then, keep asking questions, keep looking at the evidence, and decide for yourself what you believe. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator and host of the 13th Juror podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and leave a rating or review. For additional episodes, case updates, and more information about the podcast, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com. The evidence has been presented, the arguments have been made, and now comes the same question faced by every juror. What do you believe? Thank you for listening.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.